Okay, so we're looking at finding your beautiful vision. This is another point along our journey of David, looking at the life of David and discovering our own calling, personal but also corporate, and pursuing God and how that looks. Is this going to be a trouble, this mic, today? Do you think? It might be. Okay, hold on. Let's hear one for Jonathan. One! Yay! Thanks, John. And so we've discovered a lot about David over these last few weeks, and we'll discover a lot more about it, about him, and how he can point us in a helpful direction in finding our own calling, our own vocation, what we are on earth to do, who we are to be as we trod this soil, as we go about our daily lives, and as we sort of walk throughout our lives, however short or long they may be. And so we know that David wrote a lot of the book of Psalms, which of course is poetry. It's like the oldest book of poetry that we have on earth, basically. So in other words, David was a man who, he didn't talk a lot about beauty. He didn't talk a lot about creativity or artistry, but boy, did he ever embody it in the way he lived and the stuff that he left behind for us to read and to chew on and to pray through, like we talked about this last summer as we went through the Psalms. He comes at it from all kinds of different directions and talks about delightfulness and pleasantness, as in Psalm 27, which you can look up if you want, or talks about glory or adornment or the beauty of the Lord, as in Psalm 96. But there's something, as we read through different psalms and as kind of recognizing that they would have all been had music accompanying them, so there's this whole other element of beauty that's associated with them, that there's something that draws us. There's something that grabs us. There's a beauty that's there. It's not easy to describe, but it sort of draws us into itself. And that's the very nature of what beauty does. And I'm not talking about like Glamour or Elle magazine or any of those, like what our media tell us is beautiful. I'm talking about like the core essence of what beauty is, like John read from 1 Peter, like the inner beauty that we have, or just beauty in nature, beauty around us, beauty in relationships. It draws us into itself. There's something compelling, something that is drawing us into it. So there's Psalm 27, verse 4, "One thing I have asked from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple." It's a beautiful thing. And David here is writing about the beauty of the Lord, that he wants to just gaze on the beauty of the Lord, put himself in a place, put himself in a position where that beauty kind of impacts him and then draws him forward. It just kind of hits him where he lives. And I don't know about you, but as I read the Psalms, and throughout the summer we look through a lot of them, but there's something that gets tweaked inside of me. Something along the lines of realizing that life is more than what you can measure in a test tube, if you know what I mean. Or life is more than what can be put into a bank account or can be measured by a bank. There's something that you just can't quite put your hands on it, but it brings up the question, well, what is there? It's beyond. There's some kind of drawing that happens. There's a stirring that happens. There's something more. And so you can see it. I remember traveling through Greece and Turkey. And so we visited all kinds of different beautiful sites. In Thessaloniki, which is where the book of Thessalonians was written to, the people in Thessaloniki, there's this beautiful cathedral, this massive, beautiful cathedral. It was one of the first that we went to on this tour. I was in school and we were doing a tour, a Bible Land study tour. We were tracing the footsteps of Paul and John, seven churches of Revelation and Paul. And so Thessaloniki was the first one. And so this is massive old church. I can't remember how old it was, but if you've traveled through Europe, you'll have likely gone into some, but you walk in and it's just full of tourists, right? Tons of tourists all milling about. You walk in through these huge doors and you're drawn up. It's this massive expanse. It's beautifully ornate. It's ordained with all kinds of different stuff. And suddenly something hits you. And suddenly the tourists, they stop. They're not tourists anymore. They're like, I gotta sit down here for a second. I have to take it in. Well, what is it? Well, there's something, it's just difficult to define, and I'm going to do that a lot to this morning, because it's so hard to define, but it is real. It's real, and it hits you. And we sat down as we came in, and you just had to sit there and remain in awe. There's something going on that one can't quite describe. There's something like a few days ago. Who saw this? How many people took pictures of that sunset a few days ago? That was amazing. What is it about that sunset? Trevor Dineen from CBC took that picture. I just have to give credit to him. But there's, what is it that in a sunset, there's like, oh my, oh no, I guess we'd be facing that way. Oh my goodness, or the sunrise this morning. I saw it. I was up, 7:30. I suppose that's not that early, but you know how the time works these days. Wow, like it just stops you. There's something arresting about it. But what is it? Or like a newborn baby. There's a baby shower for the Bergens this afternoon. And there's this newborn baby. Like, what is it about a newborn baby that people, they hold it and they go, like, is that kind of that taking your breath away moment? What is that? I mean, yes, they're cute. And yes, sunsets are beautiful with all the color and all the rest of it. But what is it underneath or behind or beyond that it's speaking to, that it's drawing us to? Where did this come from, this sense of awe, this mystery? I remember probably one of my earliest moments of like experiences or encounters with God happened when I was probably, I think, about 4 or 5 years old. My mom, it was just my mom and I who were in our family at that time, who were Christians, and my dad wasn't following Jesus at all. So we had just gone to a little church up in Swan River, Manitoba, North Manitoba there, and had come home, and I just remember it being a really significant time at church. I can't remember why or what happened, but like the sense that God's alive, you know, like that he really, like there's this presence there. And we got out of our van. We lived off in the country in this tiny little like a log cabin kind of thing. It was the oldest. It's actually the oldest log cabin structure in the Swan Valley, Melody. That's where we lived. I lived there. There was no plumbing when we lived there even, too. But anyways, we get out of the car. I see I'm wandering. I get out of the car, and right above us, there was like this spectacular northern lights dancing, and you could hear the crackle. How many people have actually heard the crackle? It's not a myth. You can actually hear it. And different colors, and it was as if the angels were like dancing right over us. And it was like, it just took our breath away. And my mom, she remembers it too. We can talk about it now. It was just like even there, I just felt some emotion. Like it was like, it's so real to me. And this was like 40 years ago. It's beautiful. What is that? Can you relate? Have you had experiences like that? With beauty, something beautiful. It might have been when your bride or your groom was, well, the groom walking down. No, I was thinking bride walking down the aisle, but sometimes the grooms walk down. Or when you first like fall in love or meet each other, like whatever it is for you. Why do some pieces of music bring us to tears? Hamilton, the musical soundtrack for me these days. What is it for you? But why? Yeah, I know. But why? Why? So rationality or the sort of modernist perspectives would say, oh, you know, it's like, oh, there's nerve endings and they're being tickled and then, you know, it's a flush of endorphins and it causes the tear ducts to release, you know, these water things from our eyes and, you know, but why even have nerve endings? Why? Yeah, that's a good reason too. But why like have nerve endings that would like help us look at sunsets and go, oh, it begs questions, doesn't it? It points to something beyond. It's not proof of anything. It's not proof. All these experiences don't really prove anything, but they help us ask questions. They raise questions. In a similar way that the absence of beauty helps us ask questions. This is a picture from, I think, Romania, in the Eastern Soviet Union, where there were like just this brutalist architecture is like completely, just absolutely functional. No beauty whatsoever, just like everyone live in these concrete boxes. And it did something to people's spirits when they lived in those. Why? Why? These questions. There's a recognition that those kind of places, and psychologists will tell us, that those kind of places are not places fit for human habitation. They're dehumanizing. They're just not good enough. But why? Why? All of these things are pointers. They say to us there's more. And there's power in beauty. But why? Well, one of the reasons is because it points to its author. That drawing, that those moments like that, they draw us to the author of beauty, the one who is beauty. It's important. There's a few reasons. I'm just going to run through a few different reasons this morning, and I'm hoping you're going to stick with me. If you're not, like, just give me one of those really sort of dazed looks, okay? I don't actually have to ask you to do that. Sometimes you just give that to me anyways, but that's okay. I'll try to read the dazed looks, and we'll try to pace it all here, okay? Beauty is important because it points us to the one who is beautiful, its author. But beauty is especially important in our time because there's a lot of ugliness in our time. Okay, we're gonna open up the newspapers right now or the Facebook feeds or Twitter feeds and stuff. There's a heck of a lot of ugliness right now, isn't there? Okay, let's just look at the election that just happened with our neighbors just south of the border. And one candidate is more ugly than the other candidate. This the whole thing is but ugly. The way people are treating each other, the characterizations, like the caricaturizations that are happening, like this binary polarity, it's just ugly. It's bringing out all kinds of ugliness, not just in our American cousins, but in some of us who like to commentate and think about these things. It's ugly, isn't it? 2 days ago, what did we do? We honored our veterans, that's right. We did that. We thanked God for the free country that we're allowed to live in. But what was it commemorating? Wars. It's ugliness, like to the extreme. And every single veteran will tell us that. Ugliness. What do we have out here outside our doors in the little park there? The memorial garden? Or the big mural over here on the side of the wall commemorating missing and murdered Aboriginal women? It's ugly. The issues that are contributing to this, the fact that we live in a neighborhood or are gathered here in this neighborhood where it's so prevalent, where our young women are at risk, it's ugly. We live in an ugly time. There's ugliness. There's also goodness, too. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to try to like drive us right down into the into the whole depression hole there. But let's be honest about it. The water where we get our drinking water, right? It comes from Shoal Lake 40. That's an ugly agreement. That's an ugly agreement that they have with the city of Winnipeg. Actually, it's not an agreement, but it's wrong that they live under a boil water advisory while we can drink clean water. Their water, right on their shores. It's ugly. Black Friday's coming up. When is Black Friday coming up? It's soon, though, right? Isn't it soon? It's like soon. I mean, talk about ugliness. I mean, yeah, it's sweet. You get a good deal, right? That's good. I like a good deal. But, like, let's just step back from Black Friday for a second and look at what happens there. Like, all the plastic commodity is right, Lige. Yeah. There's an ugliness to that materialistic kind of concern. Like, who watched the Jets last 2 days ago or whatever? Like, that was an ugly goal, was it not? Like, that we scored ourselves. Like, what the heck? Sorry, I'm not trying to, you know, there's different levels of ugliness for sure. Weibo, anybody heard of Weibo? Weibo is a social media platform. It's twice as large as Twitter, believe it or not. But nobody's heard of it because it's all Chinese, actually. But there was this group that studied for 6 months. They wanted to try to figure out, well, what is social media doing to us as a whole world society? And so they took 6 months and they categorized their tweets. They're not called tweets because it's not Twitter, it's Weibo. So Weebs, I guess, I don't know. But anyways, and they categorized all these different posts by emotion, joy, sadness, anger, and disgust, those four different ones. And they tried to figure out, well, what are like the common themes, the common emotions? And the most prevalent one, what they found was that rage or anger was the one emotion that was most likely to spread, the most likely to get viral. And what they found is that one angry post, or one post that was like had some rage to it, had the ability to affect the follower of a follower of a follower. That's how far it went. So in other words, rage, and we can see that if you open up your Facebook profiles or Twitter or whatever, if you're on those things. And if you're not, let me tell you, there's lots of rage there. Like, you don't like your soccer coach. Well, let's like put on up a site that says, we don't like our soccer coach, and let's fire him. Or, boy, I can't believe this candidate, or I can't believe that candidate, or this sucks in the, you know, and there's goodness to kind of expressing anger. But when it gets to this rage, when it like becomes unloving, there's a problem with that. There's a problem with that. And so these sharp words or hurtful words sort of jump off of our screens or out of the newspaper or out of the media to us in unloving ways. And beginning to say things in unloving ways is becoming the norm, or has become the norm. We live, there's ugliness in our time. You're following me? And all of this negativity, I think, has left the world in desperate need of beauty. Desperate need of beauty. In need of hope. And oftentimes, Christians contribute to this. And some people say we're sometimes even the worst, because we have this, sometimes, this sort of self-righteous kind of thing, like that we're contributing, like this is God's on our side, you know? I think we need to be careful there. Well, yeah, there's a lot that's making us angry, ethical, social, political, theological ugliness in the world. But ugliness is just a sign. Just like beauty points to something else, ugliness also points to something else. And it's a manifestation of death, of decay. Sin leads to death. It's just what happens. I've never seen a beautiful dead person. It's like ugliness, it gets to there. And again, don't get me wrong, I'm not talking about like ugly in the eyes of the world, like how or beauty in the eyes of the world. I'm talking about things and situations and issues that are ugly, that just have this ugly, evil kind of tinge to it. In the end, evil always destroys. Decay and death always make things ugly. The world is under assault. God's good green earth and his creation is under assault. I'm including us in his creation. We're in a battle. We are in a battle. The evil one is launching a full-on frontal assault. And backwards assault too, like in every way. We live in evil times. It's an ugly, there's ugliness and there's sinfulness and there's evil. And so beauty is important because it's not ugly. Because it points to its author. It points to its author. So in the midst of all this evil, in all this ugliness, our task as followers of Jesus is to point to the one who is good, the one who is true, the one who is beautiful himself. That's our job. And that's why beauty is so important. It's because it captures that element. Here's another reason, and I think it'll make a little bit more sense as we come along, but every generation has big questions that they ask, okay? So I think we probably have roughly four generations in this room, maybe five, and different people kind of categorize them all different ways. There's different, so just take this one as a grain of salt, and I've got some dates here, but you can argue with the dates. That's fine. I'm not going to argue back, but it's just kind of helping us. And but every generation kind of big picture asks some real core questions, and I call them spiritual questions, actually, because they're asking, like, sort of why are we here sort of questions, like what makes us tick, what moves us. And so baby boomers, who are roughly, you know, post-war up until the 60s, something like that, their main question, and when we hear these questions, you might think, oh, I'm not in that age category, but I still ask that question. Well, that's totally fine. Like, that doesn't mean anything. It's just, this is just a little grid to help us think about things, and I think it's going to help us think about beauty in a really helpful way. But boomers ask, what is true? They want to know, what's true here? And what's wrong? What's right and what's wrong in this situation? And there's all kinds of reasons for that. I'm not going to expound on that. The next generation, which is where I am, kind of people that were born, so that's people, the birth dates, 61 to 81, 43 to 60, roughly. Generation X, Gen Xers. And we were mainly asking, what's real? Like, what? Give me something that's real here. I don't want just, like, philosophical mumbo jumbo. Give me some, like, authenticity. That was a real buzzword when I was growing up. And in the church you see this too, right? Like, I remember loving this one church that I was going to because it was so real. Like, the pastor wore ripped jeans and I wore ripped jeans, and like, it was real. Like, we could just be ourselves, right? What is real? It's a good question to ask, but that was kind of a core thing. Next generation that comes along is the millennials. I've heard of these guys, born around the millennium, the turn of the millennial. So how many millennials do we have here? Sorry. How many, like, let's just ask the Generation Xers. How many Generation Xers? Yeah. Okay. Quite a few, actually. Okay, millennials? Quite a few. Okay. Boomers? I didn't want to ask you, but yeah, you can proudly raise your hands. Pre-boomers? Anyway, no, I'm just kidding. So millennials, 82 to 81. So what is good? That's sort of an encapsulating thing. Like, what is good in the world? And that was sort of driving them, or still is driving them. And again, you could be asking these questions too. It might be. But here's a really interesting thing. And I got this from a guy named James Chung. The iGens, or the Generation Zs, or Zs, I think. And I'm sorry, some of you are like going, I don't want to be labeled. Okay, don't worry about it. Like... that's fine. You don't be labeled. But 2003, roughly until now. But these are the people that have, like, were born with these. You know, like, there's the umbilical cord to their mother, and there's the umbilical cord to these things, right? Like, comfortability with everything online, and it actually changes us. You know, like, it really does. But here's the really interesting thing. Guess what? This cohort is asking. Any guesses? What is beautiful? I think that's really profound. If we want to reach, retain, maintain, and grow our church, we have to deal with beauty. Because it's important to these guys. They're asking the question. It's not our job to say if that's a good question or not. They're asking the question. Let's show them what is beautiful. So we live in ugly times, so beauty is important because it's not ugly. Beauty is also important because it's necessary for the work of evangelism. When we're in the presence of something beautiful, it breaks boundaries because it hits us on a very human level, on a on like a on a guttural spiritual like level. It just hits us. It's those moments like that. I can tell you the truth, like in a sermon, I can tell you the truth. But I can also tell you the truth in a beautiful way through a song or something. And which one's gonna stick with you? I mean, there can be beautiful sermons too, right? He was a parliamentarian in the English Parliament in I think around the 1600s, and he became a pastor, and then he became in the city of a major church, and then he sort of gave that up. They called him the downward mobility pastoral poet. George Herbert, his name was, and he ended up in this little country parsonage, and he wrote tons of poetry, really beautiful stuff. And he says, a verse may find him who a sermon flies. In other words, a verse may find you where a sermon flies. Beauty. Beauty. Dostoevsky said this, beauty will save the world. Beauty awakens hope. It does something to us. It lifts us. Just think of that, entering into the cathedral. Or that taking in the sunrise. It lifts us. It awakens something in us. The writer of Ecclesiastes said this, God has made everything beautiful for its own time. He's planted eternity in the hearts of men, in the hearts of humans. He's put it in us, that desire, that hope. And what beauty does is it begins to awaken that hope, awaken us to that hope that's already there. He's put that into us. And when we encounter beautiful things or beautiful situations or beautiful people, it points us to the Creator, yes, but it awakens the hope that's already been put in us. This is why we need beauty. Goodness, truth, and beauty all come from the same person. They're all realities that point to God. They're not ultimate realities in themselves. And so I like what G.K. Chesterton said. God is not a symbol of goodness. Goodness is a symbol of God. Goodness points to God. We could just put in there the goodness, truth, and beauty. Those are kind of, they call them the ancient triad. I think you could just switch them all around too. It's not that God is good. He is goodness. It's not that God is true. He is truth, right? Jesus, didn't he say that? I am the way, the truth, and life, right? It's not that God is beautiful. He is beauty. It points to him. And so we're not talking about just simple mental propositions here. We're talking about this personal reality where all these truths, like the Puritans used to say, all truths meet at the top. Like they point. Beauty, all beauty points somewhere. All truth points somewhere. All goodness points somewhere. They said all truth points to the top. In other words, it points to the Creator. It points upwards. It's all perfectly embodied in Jesus. I don't think I have time. I don't want to have time for this one. We're going to skip that. But you can look at John 1, if you're taking notes, and take a look at John 1, 5 and John 1, 17. Actually, I will. I'll just say it. I'll just give it real quickly here. So these three, goodness, truth, and beauty, are all perfectly embodied in Jesus. If they point to God, then they have to be also embodied in Jesus. But where does it say that in the Bible? Well, the first chapter of John is a beautiful one, which, by the way, we're going to be looking at the Gospel of John for Advent. That should get you thinking a little bit. What? John? Wait a minute. It starts off here where the Word is made flesh. And yeah, we're going to be doing that. And we've got a little gift for everybody too to help us through that, which is kind of exciting for me. So we don't have to go through it tons here. But it says the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. The light shines in the darkness. Well, there's lots of ugliness and darkness around us, isn't there? And for John, he uses the dimension, there's a moral dimension to light. And so there's goodness. There's right and wrong. And so the light shines in the darkness. That's Jesus shining in the darkness. There's goodness. Okay? And then if you go down to verse 17, it says, grace, for the law was given through Moses. Grace, it's an important word, and truth came through Jesus Christ. Well, truth, that's an obvious one. So we've got goodness, we've got truth, but where's beauty? Where's beauty? Well, if you look at the word charis, which is grace, just think of graceful even. Like, we even combine it in our vernacular. If someone is graceful, there's an element of beauty to it, isn't there? Isn't there? Right? And so it's the same in the Greek, actually, is that this word charis has this element of beauty to it. And so, and again, it's hard to describe. There's just something, we just can't quite grab it, but it draws us. And even how the Greek is kind of laid out for us, it's like that too. It's drawing us. It's calling us to something. But we live in an ugly time, a time largely devoid of truth and goodness. And going back to the different generations, it's a postmodern world that we live in. And what is truth these days? Like, truth is all relative. Everybody has their own truth, right? We've heard that. That's what people, that's how, like, you know, go back 50 years or 60 years, there was lots of agreement about what was true. But it's not so these days. And what is good, even. And so there's this remaining one of beauty that our youngest generation are asking the question, what is beauty? And if they all lead to God, if they all point us to God, I'm not saying that everything that's beautiful is God. I'm saying they're signs, they're pointers. They call us to something beyond. They call us to the Creator. Then we need to pay special attention to it. I want us just to look real briefly at this guy. I don't know if you ever heard of him, but Alexander Solzhenitsyn, is that how to say it? That's how I say it, just because I have no idea how to say Russian. He's a famous Russian guy. He was involved in the Russian Revolution, staunch Leninist, so like idealist, ideologue kind of guy, and became and continued to be a staunch Leninist for a long time, and was in the war, in the World War II. He was a captain under Stalin, who was not. Stalin, of course, was a brutal dictator in the Soviet Union, and there was at odds, ideological odds with the Leninists that were there. And so this guy, Alexander, we'll call him, because that's the easier part to pronounce, wrote up some papers with a fellow soldier of his, like a fellow captain. And just before the Soviets were going to invade Germany, kind of the final march on Hitler, right? These papers were intercepted, and Stalin found out, and they arrested him. And they stripped him of all his rank, and they threw him into the gulags and tortured him there. They deprived him of his even most basic, like they wouldn't let him sleep even, deprived him of human torture, basically, in this isolation cell. And so this grueling, awful, crazy experience that he lived in. And to the point where when he was transferred to a cell with three other prisoners, it was like a total gift to this guy, okay? Total gift to this guy. So he was seeing the brute ugliness of the underside of Stalin's regime, right? And he ends up with cancer. He's on the operating table, and there's a doctor there. And this doctor, wonder of wonders, happens to be a Christian, a follower of Jesus. And he starts telling Alexander about how he became a Christian. He converted from Judaism to following Jesus. And he witnesses to him. He bears witness of what God had done in his life as a result of following Jesus. This impacted Alexander, but the next day Alexander woke up to this commotion in the operating room right next door. And they find that this doctor, they were fighting for this doctor's life. He had been beaten, hit 8 times on the head, and ended up dying. And this is what Alexander writes about that situation. He said, He said, and so it happened that the doctor's prophetic words were his last words on earth, and directed to me, they lay upon me as an inheritance. You cannot brush off that kind of inheritance by shrugging your shoulders. So this guy has grown up through this awful and has experienced all this crazy ugliness in his life. And even his conversion experience, there was blood on the ground, literally, from following Jesus. A number of years later, he wins a Nobel Peace Prize, or Nobel Prize for Literature. And this is what he writes. And remember the old trinity of goodness, truth, and beauty, okay? Oh, I have it here for you. You can read along if you want. Perhaps the old trinity of truth, goodness, and beauty is not simply the dressed-up, worn-out formula we thought in our presumptuous, materialistic youth. If the crowns of these trees meet, and if the two obvious, two straight sprouts of truth and goodness have been knocked down, cut off, not let grow, perhaps the whimsical, unpredictable, unexpected branches of beauty will work their way through, rise up to the very place, and thus complete the work of all three. Okay, they're good. So hear what he's saying in this very poetic kind of Nobel literature kind of prize-winning way, is that if truth isn't getting us there, I mean, it's like truth is truth, okay? But if we live in a society where truth is questioned at every corner, if we live in a time where there's so much ugliness and goodness isn't making it to the top, then maybe beauty is the way that we can point people to God. Maybe it's one of the most important ways that we can point people to God. That's what he's saying, to paraphrase. And that's, I think, my contention this morning too, is to not downplay the importance of beauty. I'm not saying that truth is thrown out the window. I'm not saying goodness is thrown out the window. Of course, we still speak the truth in love. It begs the question, if you speak the truth without love, does it cease to become true? That's a good question to ask. Psst, I think yes. That's why beauty is so important. It draws us. It draws us, allowing the beauty to rise. Beauty will save the world because it awakens hope. I have a friend, he calls himself Tim, but really Michael Felder is his German name, but when he moved to Canada, he just said, he got tired of people mispronouncing his name all the time. He said, just call me Tim. But he became a Christian, a follower of Jesus, about 50 feet under the water, scuba diving in the Great Barrier Reef. That's where he became a Christian. What was it about that? It was the beauty of it just overwhelmed him. He's like, it pointed to something, right? It's so important. And that's what Solzhenitsyn, Alexander, we'll just call him Alex. That's what he's saying. It points us to something. Here's another longer quote for you. N.T. Wright, modern day scholar and great articulator of all kinds of things, in a book called Surprised by Hope. How do you allow beauty to rise, to use Alexander's phrasing there? Part of the role in the church in the past was, and could and should be again, to foster and sustain lives of beauty and aesthetic meaning at every level. From music making in the village pub to drama in the local primary school, from artists and photographers' workshops to still life painting classes, from symphony concerts to driftwood sculptures, and put in whatever the heck else you want to put in there. The church, because it is the family that believes in new hope for creation, should be the place in every town and village where new creation bursts forth for the whole community. Why? Pointing us to the hope that, like all beauty, always comes as a surprise. Why do we value beautiness? Why do we embrace it? Because it points us to hope. It awakens something in us. It awakens something. It speaks the language of the Generation Zetters, or whatever you guys want to call yourselves. And it speaks to all of us because we are created in our God's image. And He is the author of beauty. Amen? Yes, you make good Nepalis, kind of. It's a beautiful thing. And so the challenge for us is to find the balance between ignoring the ugliness. Everyone seen any art that just sort of ignores ugliness? You often find that on Hallmark postcards, honestly. Like, it's just like, you just kind of throw, like, it makes you throw up, actually. You throw something up, you throw some color, whatever. It's just like, it's not true. There's something that's not true to it. Do you get what I'm saying? So, but also to not just go to go to the other side and like wallow in all of the ugliness. We need artists, we need creatives, we need writers, we need painters, we need poets, we need songsters, we need scientists that have an artful edge to them. We need sound people. We need all of us to live into this, that will deal with the ugliness, that will photograph it, but that will lead us out of it, bring us to hope. We need this. The world needs this. We don't need being caught in the endless sort of wallowing. But we also don't need this kind of bland, pappy schmaltz stuff that Hallmark likes. Sorry, Hallmark. But you're getting what I'm saying, right? We need both. Like, show us how to get out. And how do you get... And Jesus did this. Did you know that He did this? How was Jesus identified after His resurrection? The holes. That was how He was identified, with the holes. The wounds, the ugliness. So He dealt with... Like, He was not... They weren't erased. The holes are still on His hands, like that song that we have these days. My King has got scars on His hands. They weren't erased. But it pointed to new resurrection, to new hope, to new creation. And that's our hope. And that's what beauty does, is it awakens that hope in us. So where does this leave us? How do we be a community that welcomes beauty, welcomes the hope awakening beauty? Well, we let our artists be who they are. That's the first thing. And I think we should pray for our artists. If you consider yourself an artist, get ready to be prayed for if you want to. You don't have to be. But I think we also need to understand that it's not some people are some kind of artist. All people are some kind of artist. Why? Because we're created in God's image. And that's a whole other sermon, right? Rochelle? Our dad is the creator. And we've got His DNA coursing through our brains, or blood, whatever, veins. I remember once I was in a class, and my mentor, instructor, professor dude, that's what we call him, Professor Dude. No, I'm just kidding. He was preaching somewhat a similar-ish sermon, and there was one person in the back. They were just like, he could tell they were just agitated. And this person he knew was a PhD. They had a doctor in biology. And this person just kind of blurted out, "Biological defense mechanisms on leaves. That's what I love. I feel so passionate about it. It's so beautiful to me. It speaks of God's heart to me. But I'm not an artist. I don't know what to do. Like, I just love biological defense mechanisms on leaves." Yeah, that'll wake you up, eh, Kenny? It's not that some kind of people are some kind of artists. It's that we all can embrace this. Right? We all can. And it's our job, it's our task in community, in ourselves, in conversation with God. How do we do this? How do we be people that welcome beauty into our lives? How do we live beautifully? That's a question for lunch. But for now, we're going to pray for each other. Can we stand? It just might be helpful just to stand. I know that was long. Thanks for bearing with me, you guys. So I'm just going to pray, and we're just going to wait a little bit. And then, like I said, I really want to pray. I want us to lay hands on those people in this room right now who would consider themselves art. Like you can say, I have this. Like I am a writer. I am a song. There's songs in me. Even if you haven't written a song, there's songs in me. Or I see the world in a unique way when I look through the lens of my camera. Or whatever it is, okay, I don't want to limit. So there's all kinds of different ways, but I want us to pray for that, because we need you, and we need those skills. And also, yeah, let's just hold on there. So, as is our custom, let's just open ourselves up. And I know that we've already been open, but like, it's helpful. Open your hands, kneel. Do this if you need, just shake it off, whatever. Whatever's helpful for you. God of beauty, the one who is beautiful, we welcome this. We welcome your heart. Holy Spirit, come. We need you. You are the author, the perfecter of our faith, the creator of all things. You've set eternity in our hearts. The echoes of goodness and truth and beauty that we see around us and that we see in each other, they point to you, and they've been placed there by you. And so we don't want to take that lightly. We don't want to despise those things. But Lord, would you show us now how we can live beautifully? How we can live winsome and compelling lives through what we do, through the stuff we create, through the lives that we draw with our actions. Come, Holy Spirit.